Today's scripture reading is from Mark 7, 24 through 30. The faith of a Syrophoenician woman. Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know it. Yet he could not keep his presence secret. In fact, as soon as she heard about him, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an evil spirit came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek, born in Syria and Phoenicia. She begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. "First, let the children eat all they want," he told her, "for it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." "Yes, Lord," she replied, "but even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Then he told her, "For such a reply, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." She went home and found her child lying on the bed and the demon gone. May God bless the reading of his word.
If you've been keeping up with the news, you would have heard about the preacher from the South, the firebrand of a guy from this backward, kind of backwater kind of a town with a very small congregation, but speaking really words that were very caustic. He was speaking out against the religious extremists. And stirred up quite a bit of controversy. You know, it sparked a huge international firestorm by his words and by the things that he was claiming, the things that he was going to do. And I personally thought he was kind of crazy, and especially at a time like this when there's so much political turmoil and upheaval, especially in the Middle East, that somebody like that would stir up so much trouble. Almost like inciting craziness. Even the religious leaders and government officials were speaking against this person, this preacher, and telling him to stop. Because what he was doing, what he was saying, could cause people to get killed. And we don't really need that. I know that everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but then he should have known that what he was doing could cause all of us a lot of trouble. But I needed to see him. Now, some of you know that I've been away for a while. And I kept it on the DL. I didn't really tell a lot of people where I was going. But some of you knew, right? Some of you know where I went. And most of you who knew where I went thought I went on a vacation. But I was a person on a mission. I had to go see a preacher. And actually, it was not that hard to find this preacher because there was actually because of all the controversy that was stirred up, people knew where he was. He tried to hide. He actually tried to stay out of the limelight because of all this controversy. But I did a little bit of research, made some contacts, and I actually found where this person was and went to the house. It was bursting with people. There were just a lot of people there. The paparazzi was there. There were a lot of supporters, of course. Of course, there were a lot of hate mongers and people who actually did not like him. But I found the place. And he had his own entourage. And he had his own followers, his own congregation. And I guess if I were him, I would be kind of scared too, because you know, and his followers would probably think that somebody might want to cause him harm because of all these crazy things he was saying. So they acted like bodyguards. They were like bouncers. So it's not that everybody could go there. But I introduced myself after finding this place. I introduced myself, made known my intentions, and I got in. Now, don't get me wrong. You're thinking, you must be crazy. I was thinking, I must be crazy too. I don't usually do things like this. And I was scared. Because look at my skin color. I mean, definitely I did not fit in. I was not a part of this preacher's congregation. I did not look like him. I was not part of that thing. I looked at things differently. I looked at God and religion differently. But I needed to be there. I needed to talk to him. I had a request to make. So I was there. And they let me in. And he was shorter than I thought. It was very remarkable. His facial hair, you know, his mustache actually stood out. And I expected somebody to be mean and nasty, but he actually wasn't. He looked calm, he had a gentle face, and he spoke slowly and softly, which actually surprised me because I was expecting somebody who was like a firebrand preacher, but he's actually not. So I met up with the preacher, and I made my request known to him. Guess what he said to me? He said, yes, I have something to offer, but it's for people like us, not for your kind, not for dogs. I thought, dogs? I thought, you got to be kidding me. I'm coming all this way to come see you, and you're calling me a dog, insulting me. I was thinking, what is it? Is it my skin color? Is it because I don't look like you and your followers? Or maybe because I'm a woman? Maybe I spoke Greek, I didn't speak Aramaic like he did. I only had a simple request, something I knew that he could do. He called me a dog. Yeah. Maybe he was upset. Maybe he was judging me. Maybe he was saying that, where's this woman's husband? Yeah, I did not bring the father of my daughter with me. And of course, maybe it's not right in this. It's not kosher to these Jews that I approach as a woman just going to a man and asking for something. But why judge me? Maybe I do have a husband. Maybe my husband is very busy at work, couldn't accompany me. Or maybe my husband died. But in any case, why judge me on this? It was strange. And he called me a dog. And I don't think what got me good was that he did not only call me a dog, I think he called my daughter a dog too, because he said, you dogs. And that really upset me because all the people I thought he would understand, he would be the only person who could help my daughter. You see, my baby, she's sick. She's very ill, and people say that she has a ghost in her, like a devil, and it does terrible things to her, and it really kills me to see how she suffers. And I thought that this preacher, this firebrand they called Jesus, would be the only one that could help her. And he called me a dog. What would you have said to him if you were in my shoes? Mark chapter 7, verses 24 to 30. 7 verses in the Bible that tells us a very obscure story. A story about a woman, an encounter with Jesus. And I'm trying to get into this woman's shoes, trying to understand what Jesus was really saying to her. More importantly, I'm trying to understand what Jesus might be saying to you and to me. God, speak to us this morning. Not because of how prepared or ill-prepared the speaker is, but in spite of it. God, speak to us. Not because of how eager or how jaded we are to your word, but in spite of it. God, speak to us this morning, not because of how good or how bad we are, but in spite of that too. God, speak to us because your word is a good word, because you are a good God. Now may the words of my mouth and the meditation of all our hearts be pleasing and acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock, our redeemer. Amen. If you have a Bible, please open it with me to Mark chapter 7. We're looking at those seven verses. And this story begins with talking about Jesus going to Tyre. Maybe because he was tired. Tyre is now in the place we call Lebanon. It's on the coast of the Mediterranean, and it's actually north of Israel. And previously we had looked at this passage, at the previous passages, that Jesus was very busy. Maybe he was now just trying to find a place where he could just get some rest. And the passage said that he was trying to be inconspicuous. He was trying to hide. And actually the Gospels oftentimes mention that Jesus would hide from crowds. He would actually back away from crowds, especially when the crowds want to make him king. And we actually learn that Jesus, he actually tells us why. In the Gospel of John, chapter 2, he actually tells us that Jesus will not entrust himself to men because he knew all men. In John chapter 2, it says that Jesus knew what was in a man. And Jesus knew that a lot of people go to him for the wrong reasons. So perhaps this is why he actually tried to hide himself and just go into a house trying to not get anybody noticing. But in verse 24, we see that he couldn't keep his presence a secret in Tyre. In fact, in verse 25, it says, as soon as a woman heard about Jesus was there, she came, she fell at his feet, and she begged Jesus. So we can see that this was a woman who was very desperate. A desperate woman who actually, as soon as she found out that Jesus was there, she came, she fell, well, not like, oh, I can't get up. No, she fell at her feet, and meaning like, I'm submitting myself to you, and she begged Jesus to help him. It says in the Bible that this was a Greek woman. It means that she spoke, she was a Gentile. She was not a Jew. She was born in Syrian Phoenicia, a native of Tyre, probably. Definitely not a Jew. And what was Jesus' response to her? In verse 27, Jesus said, first let the children eat all they want. For it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs. Tossing bread to dogs. Now, many of us are thinking, including myself, was Jesus a racist? Now, some Bible scholars say that no. This verse actually tells us that Jesus was just stating his strategy. Look at verse 27. It says, first, let the children eat all they want. So some Bible scholars say that Jesus was merely stating his mission, that he came first for the Jews, and then when the Jews have heard the gospel, he will go and tell the Gentiles, the non-Jews. Okay, let me just digress for a little bit, because some of us are thinking, why the Jews? In the Bible, you know, the Jewish people, God's chosen people, some people ask, why the Jews? Why are they so privileged? I don't know if it's a privilege, but if God had to send his son to come to earth as a human being, he has to start somewhere, right? He has to start somewhere, and we complain, hey, why the Jews? Why not the Koreans? Why didn't Jesus come as an African? We don't know. I mean, of course, if God sent Jesus and he came as a Japanese, we would say, why Japanese, right? We'd say, ask the same question, same things. If Jesus came as an Ethiopian, we'd say, why Ethiopia? Why are they so privileged? So he had to start somewhere. No, even Superman came to the USA, and he was raised as an American. And then he went out and helped the whole world, right? So he had to start somewhere. He had to start somewhere. So let's not even ask that question, why the Jews? But I think in this analogy, was Jesus being a racist? I think we still need to answer that question. The fact is, in this analogy, where Jesus interplayed the children and the dogs, but looking at this passage, you really could tell that Jesus was really referring to the Jews as the children. And we all love children. Children are cuddly, cute, they're our progenies. We need children. And definitely Jesus was comparing that and contrasting that to the non-Jews and calling them dogs. No, now some Bible scholars I should point out, might argue in saying that Jesus didn't really use the word dog. He used the word, the Greek word, kunarion, not kunon. Kunon is dog. Kunarion actually means puppy, small dog. So it might conjure up for us like images of a little puppy, a little maybe a chihuahua. Right? Like a little dog. So maybe Jesus was not being racist. He was not really saying the woman was a dog. He was merely saying, oh, you're like a little poodle. But if we actually look in the context of the analogy, Jesus was merely just stating the contrast between the children and the little dogs. And the picture is really like children eating at the table and little dogs, which would be near children, would come and eat under the table or play around or try to scavenge for food. Essentially, Jesus was still saying that the woman was a dog. Whether it's an old dog or young dog or male dog or female dog, you're still a dog. Dogs were considered unclean in biblical times. In fact, throughout the Bible, whenever a dog is mentioned, most of the time, if not all the time, it is done in a negative light. A dog is never a good thing. And you might think, hey, I love dogs. Maybe you have a dog at home and you love your dogs and they're cute and cuddly, and I don't really see that as a derogatory remark. But you probably have to think about like the third world, which back then, the biblical days in Palestine, it was more like a developing country. I don't know if anyone ever gone to Mexico, like across the border town. You see a lot of stray dogs running around, mangy, dirty, kind of eating garbage and all that. Or in Trinidad, in the Caribbean, you know, we'd see a lot of mangy dogs running around. Or in Hong Kong. When I was growing up in Hong Kong, we had all these dogs running around. Nobody really owned them. And they would just kind of leave their business around. We would step on them. They're just nasty. Nobody wanted these dogs. But that was back in the 1960s and 70s. You don't see little stray dogs anymore in Hong Kong or China. Guess why? Yeah, they're all eaten now, right? But the picture is that dogs are mangy, they're dirty, they eat garbage, they do shameful things in private as well as in public, especially when two dogs come around with each other. Okay, dogs are mangy, dirty, eat garbage, and do shameful things. And that is the image of the dog portrayed in the Bible. And dogs were used, or the term dog is used as a derogatory term, a byword in many cultures. Even in the Chinese culture that I've come from, I've learned that in Chinese history, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when the Europeans were colonializing China, at one point they actually put up signs that says, "No dogs or Chinese allowed," which stirred up a lot of controversy, a lot of uproar, a lot of nationalistic pride, and eventually led to the Boxer Rebellion and other rebellions. People tried to chase the foreigners out of China because they were equating Chinese people to dogs. Because dog, you don't think about little fluffy there. You're thinking about these mangy, dirty, garbage-eating dogs that do their shameful business out in public. And here, Jesus is calling this woman a dog, just as the Bible would use the word dog to mean something dirty or not kosher, not clean. And I'm thinking about also Caleb. Did you know that Caleb, one of the 12 spies in the Old Testament? And I've oftentimes talked to Caleb about that when he was growing up, when he was a young boy. I would go up to say, "Caleb, hey Caleb, do you know what your name means?" It comes from Kalev, which means dog. Right? I think I was screwing up with his mind when he was growing up. That's why he's the way he is. Okay, but Caleb means dog, and most scholars say that Caleb probably was a foreigner. Maybe he was not a Jew. He was a foreigner, so they gave him a nickname, Caleb, dog. It's almost like giving somebody a name like, hey, Chinese or Chinky, or giving somebody a name hey, Guido, right? Or even the N word. It was a term not just of affection, but it's a nickname. It's almost like a derogatory, saying that, yeah, you're a foreigner. You're like a dog. And Jesus here is saying that this woman was a dog. Even if it's a children's puppy, it is a derogatory term. Now, if Jesus had said this to you, if you were in the shoes of this woman, you might have been offended, as I would have been, because of our identity. Our identity would have been assaulted, would have been insulted. Our identity, which everyone takes at least 20 years of the beginning part of their lives to develop. An identity of who am I? Who do people see me as? Who do I see myself as? And we try to form our identity. Who am I? Who am I when I present to the world? And after 18 years, 20 years, 30 years, for some of us, 50 years, we finally realize, hey, this is who I am, and I like the way I am. We have some pride attached to it, the way I am. And race has a lot to do with it. And I work with young people, with teenagers, so oftentimes I find the young people struggling with, you know, especially in this context, in our church, oftentimes these are Asian Americans or Chinese Americans, and some of these young people would struggle with, am I American or am I Chinese? And for many years in their lives, they would struggle and waver between these two extremes. Am I Chinese? Am I American? They would hate one at one point in time and hate the other at another point in time. And eventually they say, I don't want to go to Chinese school. I don't want to learn my parents' language. I don't like, well, learn that culture because it's stupid, it's silly. But eventually, you know, at a certain time, they finally realize their identity. And most oftentimes in college, some of these students would then go and learn the language of their parents by themselves. And I can't figure that out, but because they finally realize that this is part of my identity, this is who I am. Oftentimes, our identity is made up of who we are not. It is just as important as who we are. Who we are not is sometimes we take just as much pride of who we are not just as we identify ourselves with who we are. If you don't believe me, just ask any Chinese person where they're from, or just go up to any Chinese person and say, and especially if you know that they're from Taiwan, and you ask them, like, you're from mainland China, right? Like Patty was like, no way. Because it sort of assaults her identity, her sense of identity. Or going up to somebody from Hong Kong and saying, you're from Taiwan, right? Well, some people might say, yeah, they might shrug it off, but some people might actually be a little bit upset. Or go up to anybody who has dark skin and just call them African-American. Some of them would say, yeah, I am African-American. Some of them would say, no, I'm from the Caribbean, or my parents are from the Caribbean. Or they might say, I'm from Africa, right? And they're not African-American, they're just African. But oftentimes we mislabel people and people get upset because it assaults and it insults their identity. Or going up to a South American and say, hey, you're a Mexican, right? Yeah, it's not a good thing to mislabel people because it's part of their identity. Now, apart from race, there are all the other factors that we use to form our identity as well. Our family, our backgrounds. A lot of people take great pride in their last name or their parents or their heritage. Or their culture. A lot of people take great pride in their education. Or, you know, go up to somebody like Andrew Zhang, you know, who goes to Harvard. And you just go up and just try to mess with their minds and say, oh, you go to MIT, right? Yeah, they'll let you know they don't go to MIT because there's like this identity with people who go to Harvard. I don't go to MIT. I go to Harvard. Or you do the same thing with the other way around and go to somebody who goes to MIT, like Kathy, and say, oh, you go to Harvard, right? They would make it known that, no, they don't go to Harvard. They go to MIT. Because a lot of times we have these labels, these things that it forms our identity. We feel proud about it. Or sometimes people say, yeah, I'm not rich, but I'm frugal. You know, that's a label you give yourself just to kind of say, yeah, you're not that bad. Yeah, you're kind of poor. That's what people say. But you say, I'm frugal. Or people might say, I'm not educated. No, you don't say you're not educated. You say you're street smart, right? In fact, when we actually say the other way, say the way around, somebody who says, I'm very street smart, I grew up in a gang, and you just go and say that you're trash or you're poor. You come from the wrong side of the tracks. They would be upset because that's an assault on their sense of identity. We take great pride in who we think we are and who we think we are not. When people say something offensive to us, usually and oftentimes it's because it insults our sense of identity. And when Jesus called this woman or referred to her as a dog, I'm sure he was actually probing into her sense of identity. How does she really see herself or not see herself? When we mislabel people, when we say something offensive that mislabels or offends their identity, it quickly shows us, or that person, where we place or where that person places their confidence. Some people place their confidence, money. Well, I grew up with a silver spoon in my mouth. They see that is a very important part of their identity. Whenever Jesus addresses them and addresses these things and challenges them, Jesus is really trying to tell them, in order to come to me, you have to put down these other confidences, even if it's your part of your identity. That is why we remember the story where Jesus had an encounter with this rich young ruler who obeyed all the law, and he was very rich, and he obeyed at least 6 of the 10 commandments, whom Jesus told, you have to sell all that you have and give your money to the poor. It was an assault to his identity. It was not really about his money. It was really about his identity, who he really was. And Jesus was challenging that. Oftentimes, when our sense of confidence is not based on Jesus, those are the times we would turn away from Jesus, when he challenges us, when he says something hard and difficult to us, because our sense of identity is being threatened. So Jesus calls her a dog. 4 years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer. I had this fast-spreading disease in my body, in my blood. And of course, I was caught by surprise. For the next few weeks after I heard this from the doctor, my wife and I scurried about in a frenzy trying to find the best doctor there is. And we looked high and low, far and wide, and found that, no offense to you, Cliff, that the Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital in the New York City is one of the best or most well-known hospitals that treat cancer. But we can't just go in there and say, I want to see the best doctor. We had to find out who the best doctor was, make some phone calls and find out who knows this doctor and who knows this doctor. So through a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend, we got in touch with this one expert who treats illnesses like the one that I had. And then we went to her with great expectation that this would be the best doctor there was. And indeed, she was very smart, and she knew exactly what was wrong with me, and she prescribed the treatment, they call the protocol, and because Memorial Sloan Kettering, that hospital, they come up with all these new protocols, new treatment regimens that nobody else, like small little hospitals and small little clinics, might not have tried out. So I went there to do all these experiment stuff. But then after I met this doctor, I told my wife, I'm not going to come back again, because I didn't like her. She was kind of cocky, because she was young, but she was very smart, but she was cocky, and she was like arrogant. And she didn't have very good bedside manners. So I said, yeah, no way. I'm not going to go to her. So I chose instead a local doctor in the area, in New Brunswick. I employed their treatment program. I asked them, can we actually use your protocol, your treatment program? But I'm going to actually have it administered to me through a local doctor. And they said, yeah, we can do that. So I chose a local doctor who actually had good bedside manners. And he was a nice guy. And he smiled a lot. And he was humble. And he made me feel good. He made me feel like I'm pretty a decent person. That was because I realized I did not have a very rare form of cancer. What I had was very bad, but what I found out was that a lot of people have this kind of cancer. It's called lymphoma, and it's a cancer of the blood, of the lymph system. But that a lot of people, if it went untreated, of course I would die, but But a lot of people had this, and the recovery rate is pretty high. A lot of people got better from this, so I was not really that scared. As long as I knew I had the best treatment program, I tried to find a doctor that I liked. Now, if I was found out I had a very rare cancer, or God forbid, I discover I have a relapse, which then would be very bad, because after treatment and you're okay and you suffer a relapse, that usually means that that's a very bad thing. Now, if I had a very bad relapse or I suffered a really rare cancer, and there's only one doctor in this whole world that could treat me, would I go and actually kind of question how kind he is, how nice he is, what kind of bedside manners he has? Of course not. I mean, he could be health MD for all I care. He could be the soup Nazi, like no soup for you or no medicine for you. I mean, I wouldn't care. I would go and beg and plead and say, please help me. If there's only one doctor in the world. But I had options. Nowadays, I think a lot of Christians are saying, how come I don't experience God more? A lot of people who actually come to God and say, I want to experience God, I want to know God more, and I claim to be a Christian, but how come nothing is changing in my life? I don't experience anything. I don't sense anything. I don't see anything. I suspect it's because we have too many options. I'm not just talking about somebody going and say, oh yeah, I can trust in Jesus, or I can go to Buddha, or Allah, or Muhammad, or whatever. I'm talking about people who call themselves Christians, who stand in with arms high and hearts abandoned, and sing with all their mights, and we call ourselves Christians, and yet we still do not receive or experience that much of God. Maybe it's because when we say we're Christians, and we call on this Jesus, deep down inside we have other options. We know that if Jesus really doesn't come through, I can fall back on something else. Maybe we have our 401ks or our hefty bank accounts. Maybe we call ourselves Christians, but yet on the side we have some insurance policy, or some education because we've worked really hard at it, because one day we realize that maybe one day Jesus is not going to come through for me, so I'm going to study really hard right now in case he doesn't come through. That's called an option. Somehow we have a backup plan, a fallback plan. Maybe that is why people don't experience God that much. It's because we don't fully trust in him. Maybe that's the reason why when we go to developing countries, we hear of all these poor people who experience a lot of God. Because what poverty is, I learned, is poverty is not an absence of money. Poverty, according to Compassion International, is an absence of options. When you're poor, when you're really poor, it's not like you don't have money. It's you don't have options. Maybe that is why so many Christians tell me and tell you that they experience God, especially during times of crisis. Has anyone ever experienced that? When you're going through a really rough time, that is when you experience God the most. You don't have to raise your hand. I went through that myself. Because when you go through crises, that is what a crisis is. You run out of options. You are desperate. You know that only God can help you. And so you go to God without any options, and God comes through, and that's why we experience him. The secret is not in the poverty or the crisis. The secret is in the lack of options. In Luke chapter 18, Jesus told a story about a Pharisee and a tax collector, a sinner, going to the temple to pray. You know that story. The Pharisee prays, according to the Bible, as he prays to himself. He actually talks to himself and says, I thank you, God, that I'm not like other people, and I'm not like this tax collector, this sinner here. squares, the tax collector prayed, and he won't even look up to heaven, but instead beats his breast and cries out and says, Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner. And Jesus said, it was this tax collector and not this Pharisee who went home justified. Because whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. And the Bible tells us that God opposes the proud, but gives grace. Your grace is enough. He gives grace to the humble. The Pharisee had options. A lot of religious people have options. We feel that when we come to church and we do all this stuff, if God doesn't really forgive me, at least He would see all these good things I do. Those good works, those religious things, those are options as well. Whereas the tax collector, the sinner, somebody who's been ground to the ground, had no options. He realizes he is a sinner. He's a worm of a man. He's like a dog. And Jesus says, it's those people who go home justified. Those are the people who actually meet God. The woman we study in this story was desperate because she had no options. Jesus was her only hope. And I can relate to that story. A few weeks ago, I took the wrong medication. No, I took some Tylenol, or was it Advil, whatever it was. There was probably some interaction with some of the other pills I was taking. I'm just taking like vitamins and stuff. And I suddenly had this allergic reaction. I went through the allergic reaction. I started wheezing, and my airway got constricted, and I basically was suffering almost like an asthmatic attack. And I suddenly recalled how I was growing up as a child with asthma. Now, some of you have had experience with that. Some of you might still have sometimes asthmatic attacks. I remember myself as a child with asthma, and I was the one who could not do sports because my mom would forbid me from doing sports because that would aggravate my asthmatic condition. I had chronic asthma. And I remember my mom taking me all around the place I lived, around the country and around the world, trying to find a cure. She must have spent thousands of dollars on me, trying to find a cure for me. And nothing would stop her. She was persistent. She asked every friend she knew, asked every doctor she knew how to help me get rid of this asthma condition. I'd eaten all these weird things, all these cures. I'd seen acupuncturists. I'd seen herbalists. I'd seen doctors trained in Western medicine. I'd seen everybody. And I'd eaten all these weird things like alligator meat, eaten flowers that we grow ourselves because it has some medicinal quality. I drank urine. But, yeah, hey. Move that thought out of your head now. Okay. But thanks be to God, I don't have asthma anymore. Yeah, maybe the urine did the trick, okay? So, Vivian, you know what to do now. Okay. It had to be a urine from a virgin boy, right? Anyway, I don't have asthma anymore, and as I was growing up, okay, get that thought out of your head. Okay, no more urine. Okay. You're in, you're out. Okay. Many years later, as I was talking to my mom, one day she told me, Ian, did you know that I used to pray? And that was actually a remarkable thought because my mom was not a Christian. She was not religious, and she never talked about praying or anything like that. But one time she said to me, I prayed for you. I haven't finished the story. One time I remember I had this asthmatic attack when a family went on vacation. We were in this hotel room, and throughout the night, I had this really bad case of breakout of asthma, and I couldn't breathe. I couldn't sleep. I was going through hell. My mom stayed up with me the whole night. She did not sleep a wink because she saw that her baby son was like dying. So the whole night, she just sat me up and tried to like rub my back and tried to see if she could kind of like soothe my airway and try to, so I could breathe. I could not breathe the whole night. And she stayed up with me the whole night,
sitting on the bed and letting me lean on her back as if that would actually make it better. And I still remember looking into her eyes and seeing the pain in there, that there's nothing she could do. So years later, I talked to my mom, and this, I'm asthma-free now, and she said, "Remember, Ian, I used to pray for you." I said, "Really?" She said, "Yeah, I prayed to Jesus that he would take your asthma and give it to me." Now, I don't think God actually honors that kind of, or God works that way. No, I think the only time when you like do an exchange is with Jesus and us, when Jesus takes our sin upon himself and dies for us. So I don't think that was a valid prayer, but that it really shows you the love of a mother, the desperation of a mother, when she realizes that no medicine, no doctor could help you, and only Jesus could help you, and it opens doors to God. And it's kind of the kicker is in this, that my mom eventually, you know, some years later, died from lung cancer. So I still don't think that God was like honoring that prayer. But still to this day, I think of the desperation of a mother and her love for her child. And I think this is what this woman in the Bible was telling us. She had no options. She was desperate. And when you're in desperation, it leads to humility. When you're in desperation, you're willing to give up your sense of identity, your sense of pride. You're willing just to go to the source where you can get your help. And when you're desperate, it leads to humility. And when you're humble, it leads you to God. At least it opens the way to God. Jesus in verse 29 says, "You may go. You may go, woman." He was not kicking her out or saying, "You're a dog, get out of here, you may go." He was saying, "You may go because your request has been granted." She had access to Jesus. She got the help from God. When she went home, her daughter was fine. The daughter's demon had left. Let me ask you, how many dogs came to Tyre that day? In verse 24, it says that Jesus could not keep his presence a secret. That meant that there were other people that went to see him, and presumably other people from Syrian Phoenicia, other people from Tyre who went to see him. Most likely, a lot of people went and made requests, and most likely Jesus would say the same thing. It's not right to give the bread, let me feed the children first, and it's not right to toss them to the dogs. How many people actually came to Jesus, and how many people actually got help from Jesus? I can't find it, but I can only find one story about this woman who acknowledged that she was like a dog. Maybe she, because she was willing to forgo her identity, maybe she ran out of other options. Sometimes we refuse to humble ourselves. Brothers and sisters, my friends, sometimes we refuse to humble ourselves because we think that we are too important. We think we are too great. We're not willing to listen to negative things or criticism. In 1946, Dr. Benjamin Spock wrote a book, a bestseller around the world, and they say that it's a second bestseller after the Bible. It's called Becca, you know that. Becca, you know that book, right? Dr. Spock's book, Common Sense, Book of Baby and Child Care. I hope you don't use it, because I think it's really messed up our minds for like two generations now. Dr. Spock's book basically tells us that we need to gratify the needs of our children. We should speak kindly to them, never yell at them, because their self-esteem is so important. So we now have two generations, at least, of people around the world who've grown up on instant gratification. We've grown up on not listening to harsh things because we don't want to damage their self-esteem. We don't want to damage their self-image. So God forbid that any teacher should say that, "Oh, you failed." In fact, we've taken this concept of protecting our children so much that we actually, in some schools I was told, teachers are not allowed to grade anymore. You can only say good things and positive things to children. When they do something wrong, you're not supposed to chastise them or tell them that they're wrong, because we don't, God forbid, we should damage your self-esteem. I heard that in some schools, there's no more class ranking. Because if somebody is number one, that means there's somebody who's number two, or somebody who's number last. Then you see, that actually hurts people's self-esteem. So everybody is number one. But if you realize, if everybody's number one, nobody's really number one. That's why we now have a culture where there's so many people who are lazy, who are not willing to compete. Nobody's really working diligently because of Dr. Spock. And about this culture, about political correctness. We don't want to hurt people. We don't want to damage their self-esteem. I heard that in some schools, teachers are not even allowed to use a red pen, because seeing a red mark on their paper would traumatize the kids. What it does to us is that in the name of protecting our children's self-esteem, we have a generation or two generations of people who are unwilling or unable to hear criticism. I sometimes work with people in the youth ministry who get very upset when I correct them. When I propose that something they plan is not really well done, it's because of Dr. Spock. We have grown up a whole bunch of people who have very brittle self-esteem or self-image. But we crumble at every moment when we say something negative, so we don't say anything negative. And so we live in denial. We think that we're all that. We think that we're all good. Our generation is very hard. It's very hard for our generation to be humble. But sometimes we think humble means, you know, that somebody has to step on us and debase us and get us in the ground. And if we're really truly humble, we're going to say, oh, I'm like a worm. I'm really the worst person in the world. That is not humility. That is called false humility. Humility, what is humility? Humility is not debasing yourself. Humility is merely seeing yourself the way that you really are. That is what humility is. Humility is not pushing yourself down or trying to pretend to be inferior. Humility is really seeing yourself the way that you actually are. In the context of the Bible, humility is agreeing with God's assessment of you and me. In the book of Revelation, Jesus speaks to the church in the Laodicea, and he says to them, "You say, I am rich. I've acquired wealth and do not need a thing. But you do not realize that you are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire so that you can become rich, and white clothes to wear so that you can cover your shameful nakedness, and salve to put in your eyes so that you can see." God has an assessment of you and me. A lot of us, because we're so unresilient, because we're so afraid, and because we're so high and mighty that we think, we're unable to hear that. And so we cover our ears and we cover our eyes, when in fact Jesus was telling us of our true condition. Mark those words in verse 28. And I believe they are really the key words in this passage, where the woman says to Jesus, after being called a dog, she says, "Yes, Lord. Yes, Lord." Of course, she says, then even the dogs eat the crumbs from the table that the children kind of drop. But she says, "Yes, Lord." She was in agreement with Jesus that she was, in fact, a dog. That, in fact, she was mangy and dirty, and she eats garbage, and she does shameful things in private and in public. The woman was not a dog because we were comparing her to a Jew. The woman was a dog because she knew she was being compared to God. In the same manner, all of us should understand that this is the correct assessment of our human condition. We are mangy, we're dirty, we eat garbage, we do shameful things in secret and in public. We are dogs. And the woman was acknowledging that Jesus was the bread of life given to dogs like you and me. And when she acknowledged that, she had access to Jesus. This context of this passage. Whenever you study the Bible, you have to see it in context. You have to look at what's going on in here. Why is Jesus addressing this? Just before this, last week, Pastor Jeff preached on the passage right before. Remember what that was? If you don't, you can cheat and look in your Bible, which is actually a good thing to do. We had just finished looking at a passage where the Pharisees had an argument with Jesus, saying that, hey, how come your disciples don't wash your hands when they eat? It's unclean. That's what the Pharisees think. They think of things in terms of clean and unclean. They think that if I remain clean, religiously clean, God would accept me. But God's acceptance has nothing to do with washing hands or acting religiously. The key of getting access to God is not in these outward things we do. Religiosity, good works, or blowing up yourself for your faith. It's in humility. Because all these things, identity, options, what's the other one? Identity, options, denial. They all speak about pride. Humility is the password. It's the passcode. It's the gateway. It's the doorway to God. Jesus helped this woman not because she was a Jew or not a Jew. He helped her in spite of those things. It was not a matter of race, but it was a matter of humility. We have to acknowledge that we have a need and be in agreement with God. In closing, let me just ask you, has God seemed far away lately? Has God seemed to you like He's traveled to another universe? That somehow your relationship, if you have one, doesn't feel that real or feel that vibrant anymore? Remember the woman said, "Yes, Lord." I remember as a young man, I sat under the tutelage of a pastor in my home church, and I've told you this before, and he asked the same question, "Do some of you feel that God seems far away these days?" He says, if you do sense that way, ask yourself, when was the last time you said no to God? Because he says, I suspect that is the beginning of this lull in your life. Because when you start saying no to God, even though it might be a small thing and maybe it was a long time ago, you will stop growing from that point on. God would seem like He's far away because you said no to Him. You might be thinking, no, I want to move beyond that. I might say yes in the other things, but when was the last time you said no? Because God will always bring you back to that decision, that one point in life where you said no. And unless you say yes here, He cannot bring you forward. He cannot bring you past that. He'll always bring you back to that one point. And that one point where you said no might have been because of your identity, how you see yourself or how other people see you. And if you said yes to God, that one would have been threatened. That would have been destroyed. Or maybe at that point, you had other options. When Jesus said, will you say yes to them? Will you be in agreement with me? You're sensing that, well, I don't really need to trust Jesus because I have all these other options. I'm doing all these other things. I have all these backup plans. Or maybe at that one point, you were in denial and you're saying that, I don't really need Jesus because He says mean things to me. I can do better. But for whatever reason, at that point in time, at that particular junction in your life, you had said no. Maybe today is the day we need to get our lives going again with God. As He brings you back to this point, I don't know what this point is for you. I think for each of us, it's a different point. And I hope that some of us are feeling, hey, I have no problem. I'm walking with Jesus. Everything's, we're like peas in a pod, frogs in a log. But for some of us, I suspect that you're like me. I feel that at a certain point in time, I said no. Maybe at the beginning of a new semester in school, or maybe at this point in time where you're starting something new in your life, maybe it's a good thing to today to come back to the point and say, yes. I would like to give us a little time to think about what that time is, where you might have encountered Jesus and he said something hard to you, difficult to you, just like this woman, this Syrian Phoenician woman came to Jesus for a special request, and Jesus says something that's almost offensive or something that really threatens you and makes you scared, and you just couldn't say yes. I would like to give us some time to think about that, and afterwards I would like to teach you a song, and it's a yes song. It goes like this. I say yes, Lord, yes. I say yes, Lord, yes. I say yes, Lord. I say yes, Lord. I say yes, Lord, yes. So why don't we think about it a little bit? Let's close our eyes and if Jesus is actually calling us, calling you, to that point in time where he says, you need to humble yourself, because otherwise, there's no access to God. Maybe to ask yourself, are you desperate enough? Are you running out of options? Because sometimes it's actually a good thing. And try to identify if there's something in your life you need to get right with God. With eyes closed and heads bowed, if we could just spend half a minute, if even that, thinking about that. And when you're ready, maybe we can sing that song one more time. Then I'll pray for us and close this time. If this is what Jesus is saying to you, then, and you're ready, then join with me. We can still keep our eyes closed. I say yes, Lord, yes. You can whisper it if you want. I say yes, Lord, yes. I say yes, Lord. I say yes, Lord. I say yes, Lord. Yes. One more time. I say yes, Lord, yes. I say yes, Lord, yes. I say yes, Lord. I say yes, Lord. I say yes, Lord, yes. Jesus, we say yes to you today. You know, Lord God, how far we've traveled and how far we've fallen away. And today you bring us back to you. We have to assume maybe you even went to Tyre and you pretended that you were hiding, but you were there for this woman. And we can even see that you're here today. And you're drawing us to yourself. And we might be thinking that we're looking for you, but all this time, you're the one who's been looking for us. And you're calling us to come back to yourself. To find that in you, we have all the riches of the world. That in you, we have all the education in the world. That in you, we have all the help this universe holds. Today, we come to you with our identity. Maybe we pride ourselves in being rich or poor or Asian or Caucasian or Hispanic or whatever we call ourselves. Or what we are not. We come and say, we can only be Christian. Maybe today we come to you and we say, Lord, I had all these fallback plans. Maybe that is why I couldn't really get close to you, because I only came to you haphazardly, lackadaisically, not with a full heart. But today I say yes to you. Or Jesus, maybe it's because my self-image is so brittle. I've been taught that I need to look out for myself. I need to always be number one, and I will not listen to criticism. But today I acknowledge that I am like a dog. Compared to God, I am nothing. That I'm a sinner, that I've done shameful things. I eat garbage. I take garbage into my mind, into my life, and I need you. And so I agree with you and say yes, Lord. May those of us who say yes experience you and find that you are faithful to us. And for those of us who still cannot say yes, continue to speak to us. Be persistent and be patient with us. And help us, O Lord, because your grace is enough. We're not praying these prayers because we're good or because we are faithful. You don't love us because we are good or faithful, but you love us in spite of those things. So help us, O Lord God. When we say yes to you, may we find you. May we find that you're doing amazing things in our lives. We pray these things in your name, Jesus. Amen.